It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. We talk about book things. This is episode 353, I think.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure, but only barely sure. Recording on Thursday, February 13th, 2020. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Rebecca Shinsky. Now that we're recording stuff out of order for bonus episodes, the sequential nature of this has gone thrown into turmoil. By the end of today, I'll have two more in the can that are happening in the future. You know, I don't know where I am.
I got excited about, we talk about book things, because I think I'm just going to write a different intro every week now that we've decided scrap,
yes,
you know, what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. And I thought I had the right episode number, but I also don't know where we are in time and space, because we did a bonus episode yesterday. We're doing one today. There was one from last week. Like, what? Where even are we?
Yeah, I should say, I guess to give you a heads up for the next bonus episode, if you want a few days to get ready for it, if you want to go rewatch some Bourdain, we're going to do 20 years later of Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain, which came out in 2000. Hard to believe it's been 20 years, and I've got a lot to say. I'm going to save it for when we record an hour from now, but we're looking forward to talking about that one. And I think this is one of those topics where, unless we were looking for things to do with bonus episodes, we never would have thought to do this, but I'm so glad we are.
Me too. Yeah, and we talked a little bit about it when he died, and I also think, yeah, we wouldn't have given ourselves an hour to do a whole episode about his work and about Kitchen Confidential without these bonus episodes. And I'll say, if your ears perked up and you want to go on this journey with us, there's a really beautiful, newer, like updated paperback edition that has Tony's handwritten annotations inside it. I think those were done in 2012. Mm. And now they've added an introduction by Eric Repair since Tony's death. It's a paperback with deckled edges and French flaps. It's a beautiful book. It's the edition that I read this time around for this project, and I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, I should also say I first did Kitchen Confidential on audio, which Bourdain himself
narrates. Yeah, that's a good experience.
Narrates. It's I did my first go around on all the Bourdain books, and I read them all. It was all on audio, and he's unbelievable as a narrator. I mean, it's not a surprise that he was so good on TV. You could tell he was going to be good on TV just from his narration. It's natural, it's funny. I think actually I fall in this category. My writing cadence and my speaking cadence don't actually sync up extremely well. Mm. Whereas he talks like he writes, and that's not a put down on his talking or writing, which sometimes it's used as a euphemism for he's not a good speaker or not a good writer, but like his intonations and rhythms match what he puts down on the page in a way that's really quite unusual in my experience of writers and narrators. People are great narrators, and I prefer someone who's writing about themselves to be their narrator, but there's just something, somehow he writes the way he's going to say the thing out loud. Or it goes together so well, and I'm stepping on things I have to say about it, but I do really recommend. And Libby has it. This one now, I looked at it. There's no wait time for Kitchen Confidential on my local public library, which means a pretty good chance you can get it. And when I first listened to it, I blew through it. Man, it's really interesting. A lot of it's dated, but we have got a lot of interesting things to say about it. But I'm so glad we found an excuse for work reasons to go back and revisit. All right, let's do a sponsor and then we'll come back.
It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I am delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
Well, things seem to be going great at the Romance Writers Association. Things really have turned around over there in the week since basically Courtney Milan was removed from her position on the ethics committee. I'm now trying to remember the nature. It's kind of like the Big Bang. Like, yes. Things happen so fast in the nanosecond after that it's hard to remember the initial
state of it. Yeah, I think that was the catalyst for everything. And in her reaction to that, she dragged into the light sort of a history of upsetting, problematic, racist, discriminatory behavior that she is alleging happened behind the scenes at the RWA. Then a lot of other people felt empowered to tell their stories about what they had experienced once the dam starts to break. And several members of the board resigned at that point. Also, the board president, Damon Swade, resigned, and the executive director, Carol Ritter, resigned in early January. The rest of the board resigned yesterday. The folks who were remaining were the treasurer, Nan Dixon, and directors at large named Hannah Reese Barnes, Kate McMurray, Maria Powers, Melanie Zaretto, and Eliana West. They are resigning effective immediately, and there is an election, a special election will be held between March 13th and 20th. So maybe their resignation is effective then, to elect a new, basically interim board that will serve until August 31st, at which point the organization will elect an ongoing board per their regular schedule. This is I think really could be the death knell. Like, one of the conversations that I've seen happening behind the scenes at Book Riot about it is a joke that's not a joke that the W now in RWA stands for white, because who is going to volunteer to be on this board at this point? There's no one left to have an entire board turnover and be without an executive director at the same time is a really tough spot for any organization, because traditionally the executive director is the one who maintains an organization's mission and forward motion as over time the board turns over with different members. And there's no one here who will come March 13th, they won't have anyone there who has been in leadership in the organization before, maintaining any kind of continuity. And that's real tough.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the ins and outs. I'm sort of in the Nobel Prize jury kind of situation where I don't know the bylaws and how everything's put together. It seems to me that if RWA is going to survive in a way that the people who have resigned out of protest would be happy with, some of those people who aren't happy would have to volunteer to run for it. It is one of those situations. Why do I want to save this corpse of a thing that's been so crappy to me and people like me and people that I care about? Why don't we go do our own thing? Like, is there so much value in the idea, the structure, the bylaws, the history of the RWA that the ARW, American Romance Writers, that has different bylaws and a different history and a fresh board and fresh thing, like, what is there to say versus starting new? And I don't know enough about RWA, and I don't follow the TikTok of what's been going on well enough, but your whole board resigning for an interim board that's then going to be reelected kind of feels like the fall of Rome situation. Like, all the senators have stepped down and the emperor is dead, and well, that's kind of the end of it. It's hard to imagine resuscitated in a way that makes
sense. How do you keep the wheels going forward when there's no one there to guide the vehicle? I almost said the ship, but ships don't have wheels. We're 4 minutes into this thing and I'm mixing
They have the wheel that they don't drive the boat, but they control the boat. Yes, they don't have either.
Right.
They don't have wheels, right,
this is
or
where wheelhouse
rudders
from,
or engines or yes. They don't have any of it. And the other thing too is, unless a bunch of people that have left, especially the people, the writers and mostly women of color in this particular genre, come back, you don't want to be a part of what's going to be left of this, even if it survives. I don't think, talk about W before. It's only going to be more so now.
Exactly. That, if you are a white person who's a member of RWA or involved in the romance writing community, and you wish to be an ally to the women of color who have stepped away for what sound like very good reasons, it's tough to justify staying in this version of the RWA or taking on leadership. I can see a way where it would be like, well, there's an opportunity to try to do something different and to take this in a new direction. But I think there's real value in recognizing when something has run its course and allowing, like, stepping away and making space for, like, gracefully making space for something new to be made. And I think these women who have stepped away are going to make something new, whether the RWA, like, participates and supports it or not. But for individuals there who are deciding about which path to take, yeah, I think it would be wise to get on board with whatever the new thing is, or at least hang back and see what what new thing develops that might actually succeed in being inclusive and representative.
And if someone knows, or they've read something that lays out, like, what would be the case for a person of good intent, let's say, to save the RWA structure? Like, what's there that's worth salvaging? That that I don't have a good sense of. I know a little bit of what they do, but if it's bylaws and an email subscription list and membership fees, in this day and age, especially given what has happened to RWA, it feels like you could reconstruct, or not reconstruct, but make a new house rather than try to get all the bugs out of this particular one. Sometimes it's more efficient just to start the new thing. This next story is interesting for about 10,000 reasons, I would say. People sign book deals all the time, and we tend not to talk about book deals unless it's an unusual one where we have to scream about Marilyn Robinson or something else like that. I've thought about, and I was going to pitch this to you, Rebecca, at some point. I do actually follow book deal announcements fairly closely because I'm interested in. We see things that don't rise to the level like this one would of making its own show, but, like, what if we did a monthly segment on one of the regular shows of, like, three to five interesting book deals that happened this month that wouldn't get their own story, but, like, as a roundup would be interesting. What do you think about that?
I'm into that. Let's do it. Yeah. And then maybe I'm envisioning then, like, setting a tracker for when those books are eventually supposed to come out to follow up on them. Cause that's also connected to
this
next story.
Yeah. I don't remember. I'll find it for next week, but something was coming out. I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And the release date is spring 2023. And I was like, okay. I feel like since I've been watching them, the timelines have been moving up, but every now and I get a reminder, like, that book's not done, is what that tells me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a separate different thing. Anyway, this story is Colin Kaepernick, I guess now really more of a former football player than a current football player, if you don't know, took a knee during the national anthem and then was injured, and then, boy, this is another thing where I've sort of followed headlines, depending on how you read the situation, was either blackballed by the NFL for his political opinions, or I guess the most generous reading is that he wasn't worth the hassle that comes with signing him to actually play for your football team, and even that's pretty bad. But anyway, he's become an interesting figure in progressive politics, especially about race, that has been very cagey, and I use that not negatively, but, like, he's profited, like, he had this huge Nike ad, right? He took, you know, he's made money off his position, which, grab that bag. No shouts there. But even this is a continuation of that. Like, he's releasing a memoir under his own Kaepernick Publishing. There will be an ebook and a print book. And then the audio rights are going to Audio. And then there's going to be deals beyond that. This to me is so fascinating because I think this will sell. He's one of those people that we've wondered about. Who's going to do a full, what big person, big player, I mean, literal and figurative player in books, is going to do a largely self-published move? And we keep waiting for someone. We've seen, like, experiments here and there, but does this count, Rebecca, as the one we've been looking for, or why or why not? Tell me what you think.
I don't know, and I'm, like, extra fascinated. One of the 10,000 reasons that this is interesting is that in 2017, we did talk on this show about how Colin Kaepernick had gotten a $1 million book deal to write a memoir for the One World imprint at Random House. And I know this because I searched for Colin Kaepernick's name in our now 475-page long podcast agenda.
Oh, God.
I was like, I know we've talked about this before. So in 2017, he inked a deal for $1 million, and that must not be happening. So we don't know the story there. I'm going to guess this is, like, probably functionally the same book that he was intending to write there, but something has happened. He got out of the deal, or they let him out of the deal. Who knows? Maybe we'll hear that story eventually, but not doing it with Chris Jackson at Random House anymore over at One World. So that I wonder, like, did he want to take on publishing it himself, or was he released from his responsibility to PRH for some reason? That's, I think, a really interesting question. I think he stands a shot at doing this. The Audible thing is really interesting. Like, I think it recognizes, especially like memoir and especially celebrity memoir, seems to do really well on audio, and that there are folks that are going to gravitate toward that. And that these days, if a book looks good and is well produced, and it's, you know, listed online for sale at all the places that you can buy books online, if he has a good ad campaign behind this, and I think that he has the money to fund one, like, hire a good marketer and a good publicist, most readers won't have any idea that he's publishing it himself. So all that really matters is, I think it has a great shot at being successful, and it might be the story that we've been waiting for, because it, to be a big swing that is successful, or at least really interesting, it needs to be done by somebody who can treat it the way a publishing house would treat a big release like this by a celebrity, with like very effective marketing and publicity. And Kaepernick certainly is a good, like, he's a good mouthpiece for himself. As you said, very cagey about when and how information about his projects and what he's up to gets out. And Audible has been experimenting a lot with how to do stuff like this. So really, I'm just fascinated. And also really glad that we're going to get this, because I think we talked at some point, like mid-2019, wondering aloud where the Colin Kaepernick memoir was. So I'm happy that it's going to exist.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, like, to say this is self-published is only maybe partially true. Who knows? Maybe he's hired traditional kinds of people to work for him at Kaepernick Publishing. I don't know. Maybe it's rather than self-publish his own print, and you really get into blurry lines there. But Audible exclusively releasing the audio and a multi-project deal with Audible. Audible is a publisher. Like, that's a thing, I guess, maybe I need to reframe my mental model of what self-publishing. They commission, they buy, they produce, they do all the things that a publisher does. So maybe I'm wrong to say this will be self-published. One of the publishers, one of the distributors, I don't even know how you talk about this. Right? It's like Parasite, who just won the Oscar, right? It was distributed by Neon, right? So their producers get the Academy Award, I think. But they just bought the movie that when it was done. So it's very difficult to say. I guess when we talked about self-publishing in the what feels now like when the dinosaurs ruled the earth in the early days of like ebooks and stuff, I think the thing we didn't see coming was the transmogrification of platforms into publishers, right? That publishers and platforms could meet in the middle. And I don't think there's any better example of that than Audible. And plus, they have such a dominant market share of audiobooks that people pay money for rather than get from the library, that it's a platform, it's a publisher. Like, you can't be a self-publisher and have an audiobook and not be in bed with Audible to some degree, right?
I guess And it turns out I'm like now down at the very bottom, like literally the last line of this piece from Deadline about this deal, that Kaepernick Publishing will be in partnership with Melcher Media, which is distributed by an Ingram brand. And Melcher Media, I can see, has done books in partnership with Martha Stewart, Oprah, the Dear Evan Hansen musical. Oh. They produced the book for, like, the companion book for Stranger Things and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Hamilton and Mr. Robot and a Nike thing. Actually, Nike and Gatorade and a whole bunch of sports-related things. Oh, and L.L. Bean, so I'm going to be buying that immediately. Mm. But, like, legit establishment and beautifully made books. Like, one of them is Oprah's The Wisdom of Sundays and The Path Made Clear, which is a beautifully presented and packaged book that just collects a bunch of things from Oprah's Super Soul interviews. Mm-hmm. But, like, I received that as a gift. I had no idea. That, like, I work in books, and I didn't even look to see who published it.
I guess there's another way to think about it. Okay, so it's Kaepernick Publishing. Sounds like they're basically hiring or will do some sort of rev share with these other corporations. Like, Is that self-publishing? Like, if you hire a mercenary squad to help you do the thing?
Yeah, I don't, I don't
what
know.
What do we mean? Not, what do we talk about when we talk about self-publishing anymore, I guess?
That's not a podcast I want to host.
No, no.
It does say here near the bottom of the piece as well that Kaepernick claims he founded his own publishing company to reinforce the importance of Black ownership, which will extend to authors, writers, and creators with whom he works. So this sounds to me like he is trying to functionally generate his own imprint.
Yeah.
That will be produced by Melcher Media and distributed by this Ingram brand. Mm-hmm. Which this is a great way to have creative control of what you want your thing to be, and then to have, like, if he's in charge of the content functionally, then work with folks who have access to manufacturing and production and you know, distribution, and presumably there's some marketing in there somewhere. I think this is really smart, very interesting.
It does make you wonder. I guess if you want to be the ultimate yes, no person, right? Then even if you have to build the world anew and basically make your own imprint or publishing house, if that's what you want, you get out of your deal with Random House.
Yeah.
Even as great as Chris Jackson and One World is, mm-hmm. and I think they are great. They're publishing interesting books. They did Water Dancer. They did Kevin Wynn's book, New Ways, which we were excited for. And there's other books on there. I think, is the next Yad Jesse from One World? But anyway, really interesting books that Kaepernick's book would fit would into, except if he wants to be the one calling the shots, ultimately, you can't do that. You don't want to do that. So you either have to self-publish, which I guess basically means do your own titles only in sort of a do-it-yourself kind of way. This is not the DIY nature that we, I think, ascribe to self-publishing as a program. This is someone with a lot of political and cultural clout and some scratch that's saying, wait a minute, if I'm going to do this thing, let's own the sucker.
Yeah, and I think, like, that's an excellent point about having ultimate creative control of it, because even if you get your own imprint, like, even if PRH offered Colin Kaepernick his own imprint, or to to hop up in the conversation, Bourdain had an imprint with Echo. You are the curator, but you're not the end all be all decision about, like, the P&L sheet and what kind of advances you're going to get to give to people. You still are then reporting to, like, the larger publisher and the structure of that publishing house. So, like, this is the way to do it if you want full control of how a thing looks and whose books you publish and how many of them and what kind of political risks you might be taking with them.
Right. Well, and financial risk too. I mean, you call the shots, you also are forking over the checks, at least at some degree. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing by having your book published with a traditional publishing house is they're footing the bill. Now, if it goes great, they'll make most of the money. But if it goes sideways, that's why you got your advance. So there are trade-offs that come with it. It's not, now that I think about it this way, it's not surprising to me that Kaepernick, knowing what he stands for, knowing his own experience in the NFL, frankly, and some of these things about the NFL, that he came around to the idea, for whatever means, to say, you know what? I could be the owner rather than the player. Like, I don't want to repeat what happened to me in the NFL.
I hope he'll talk about it.
Yeah, even in a more, I don't know, conducive environment like One World would have been. Interesting to see. Okay, let's do another break and then talk about some more fun stuff. I guess this is also nothing. I think if we did a search in our Google Doc, we'd get some hits for this one. In somewhat of an about face, or maybe, I'm not really sure how to describe this, but Amazon is ramping up its, I don't even know what you'd call it. It's, I don't know, kicking off Nazi books from Amazon's bookstore. And Amazon's bookstore, of course, is not a physical thing. It is the idea of Amazon.com, the place that people go to buy books. The headline here in the New York Times, I think, is very interesting. It said that Real once said it would sell the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now has banished some objectionable volumes and erased swastikas from a photo book about a Nazi takeover. This is the kind of problem you have if you're a platform and you basically publish, you sell 60% of books and 90% of ebooks. You're going to get a lot of, let's call it, charitably bycatch here. And then what do you do about that? And historically, Amazon has been more hands-off than maybe someone like me would be, I think, in this regard. Now, the scale of this is hard to do because there's so many, like, the number of, we talk about self-publishing books, there's also a lot that no one ever hears about that are nasty and terrible. What do you do with those? How do you staff? How do you filter? this is good ultimately, I think, but it does get to, you almost have, like, we've said this before about these giant platforms, you start to have sort of like government kinds of problems, right? Government kinds of questions, because basically you've regressed to the mean and you're taking on everyone. Unlike the government, you're not constrained by the Constitution necessarily, where you have to have to let people publish things, or at least, you know, largely so. Amazon has its corporate right that they're not going to get prosecuted for censorship, because this is not what censorship is. Don't email us. So ultimately good. I wonder why now, here at the end, I guess, of feeling like Amazon's dominance, they've decided to turn it around at this point, when they could have done it a long time ago. You can hear me struggling with what to make of this, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I think that's a great question. I think that the cultural conversation has moved in a way that now there's a lot of incentive for Amazon to do this, much more incentive than there was. Like, in there, further down in this piece from the Times, they note that in 2010, when news media discovered a self-published book that was about, like, how to be a pedophile functionally.
Yeah.
That was available on Amazon. Amazon's reaction was to issue a statement saying that they believe that it is censorship to not sell certain books simply because we or others believe the message is objectionable. That statement ultimately was weakened when there was a lot of objection, and Amazon did ultimately pull the book. But I think that despite the fact that we continually have to repeat on this show, and that, like, the BookJournet is perpetually talking about the fact that a bookseller deciding not to stock a book is not censorship, I think we are, like, gradually coming to a place where more people understand that. And Amazon's mission is to provide a positive customer experience. And that's the explanation that they're giving for pulling these books, is like, this is not a positive customer experience for us to be selling white supremacist material. I agree with them. And there's a great point made here that most brick and mortar bookstores do not stock white supremacist material for the exact same reason. It would alienate customers. Like, I don't want to noodle down to the Fountain Bookstore in downtown Richmond and be, you know, like, browsing romances and current events and then come across Nazi propaganda on the shelves. Mm. This would not make me happy about giving my money to that business. So that we think of Amazon and online retail as somehow different, like, maybe because they have unlimited shelf space, so to speak, they should stock everything, I think is incorrect. One of the people interviewed in this piece is someone who's been a bookseller since 2001, and saying he doesn't condone the material, but he believes people should be free to read what they want. And, like, this idea that Amazon not selling something means that a person can't read it, or that the material has been censored, like, those, the logic just does not follow there. I think that Amazon has come around to, this is the better move for optics and PR. And I hope that this also aligns with Amazon's values as a company, that they don't wish to be a place that makes white supremacist material available. But, like, the baseline business case, I think, is compelling at this point.
You could be right that maybe it was someone where there's, like, enough of this. Like, I don't know what maybe the business, they convinced someone, or someone got control that decides about this. Like, you know what, I don't want to be a part of this, and we can do this now. Maybe we could have done it then. They almost certainly could have done it then. It could be that simple. Sometimes you stop doing things you don't want to do and you change your mind, which I think we also sometimes forget that corporations are just made up of people, and people change and things turn over, like, and they may just want to do stuff differently now. It doesn't have to be, you know, a foolish consistently is the hobgoblin of little minds, as Emerson once said. You don't have to hold on. You don't have to keep a position just because you once had it, especially if the new position is a better one, too. I think we were talking about this maybe last week or in some other context. We've been podcasting so much, I now have no idea when we said what to whom when. But I think your point about people equate being able to have their book bought on Amazon or available through the library or bought at their local bookstore with censorship is because they're sort of skipping over a middle term in the syllogism, which is they equate freedom of speech with being able to make a living saying whatever they want. They equivalent being able to write whatever they want with having access to the same platforms that other kinds of speech do. That's not what it is. You can still get a printer and print up your screeds and distribute them by hand or sell them by mail order or whatever, as long as it doesn't break the law in some other way. You know, like, I think one of the things about the pedophilia book was that there was a case that was actually illegal because it was condoning or facilitating or encouraging or otherwise, you know, basically making unlawful acts easier, to helping people commit unlawful acts. Kind of like the anarchist cookbook. You can't, it's not legal to tell someone how to build a bomb. That's illegal, I think. I'm pretty sure about that. Anyway, but like people equate, they move the goalposts from being able to print common sense on a printer like Thomas Paine did in their basement and distribute it by hand. That's what we're talking about in freedom of speech. We're not talking about you can sell an ebook on Audible that says whatever the hell you want, no matter how bad it is.
Well, and we're really talking about like the First Amendment is the freedom to speak without punishment by the government.
Right, you know, right.
It's not even about can you sell your book at all, much less can you sell it where you want to be able to sell it, but can you express the opinion that you have without being thrown in jail or killed? And I think, you know, as you were talking and my brain was continuing to spin on this, I think maybe one of the reasons that Amazon is doing this now is the stakes feel higher now because we have spent like 4 years since the last election cycle looking at what white supremacist propaganda does in our culture. And maybe somebody at Amazon has started to feel responsible for facilitating that information being disseminated and not wanting to be a party to that. Because like it was very present what happened in Charlottesville. It's been very present on the internet for the last several years since the last election cycle. It continues to be on the table in both very like subtle dog whistle kind of ways and very direct ways. And we're rolling into another election cycle that maybe they've just decided we don't want to be part of helping this crap get out there. And I'm down with that too.
I mean, the slippery soap argument, which I don't believe in, but just to throw it out there as well, if they can do that to this book with things that I do agree with, or I feel like people actually don't mean this when they say this, they could do it to other books. And the truth is they could. And that's where the marketplace of ideas thing kind of comes in. If they did it and people didn't like it, they would go elsewhere. And then Amazon's position would weaken. I think probably what you said both now and what we probably said then, or at least you said then, which it was in their financial interest not to police them in the old days. But now maybe it is in their interest and they care. It could be they both of those things could be true as well, which may be most likely.
Right. And the reality for these people is that if there really were a demand for this material, they would be getting hits to their own websites where they could charge $25.99 for a PDF download of the exact same text.
Right. Yeah. Work on your SEO, people. That's all I've got to say about that. Let's see. I guess this is in news from local garbage fire messes. Let's see, what's new about this one? What is there any spin on this? Is this a shirt, different day situation?
I've only been able to get to a little spin on this. In Grand Haven, Michigan, a group of parents are trying to get the school board to remove books that cover topics related to sex and sexuality, which the parents consider to be sexually explicit. Now, the titles of these books are not mentioned in this piece. I've Googled around for a bunch and I couldn't find anything. But the books in question were available to children as young as fifth grade and covered topics including rape, statutory rape, and oral sex. But we don't know, like, were the books that include that talked about oral sex available to fifth graders? Are we talking about like a fifth grade book that someone perceived as problematic, and then like a 10th grade book that contained like there's just not enough info here. The school board, I think, has done a very thorough job trying to help parents understand what books are available and give them ways to be involved. So they announced earlier this week that if parents are concerned about what their kids are reading, they can request their child's login in order to monitor the content that the kid is checking out. They can request a weekly email that lists the materials the child has checked out. They can meet with school librarians to request restrictions on specific titles or searchable genres. And they can choose not to have their child check out any books or even use the school library and instead provide their own independent reading material, which my eyebrows are like all the way at the top of my head about that last one. This seems like a school board really trying to find ways to make parents feel comfortable without actually removing material from a library. That's a tough line to walk. And it seems like trying it. Some of the parents are unhappy because it puts the burden on the parents. Like, literally, that's the term used in this piece to determine. And as I Googled around for it, the pieces that I found were paywalled, so I wasn't able to get into them. But it looks like this is a small group of parents who are, it's part of a group that's like Grand Haven Conservative Parents or something like that. And that the titles are actually all related to LGBTQ issues. But very, I think, tellingly, or at least interestingly, the specific titles of the books aren't listed in any of the news pieces I was able to find about this. So I think this is same shirt, different day, with even more like obfuscation around what the real motivation of these parents is.
Because you can see, I mean, as you're sort of intimating right there, this could go a couple different ways. It really could be the library saying, okay, maybe what if we were more of a clearinghouse for helping parents make decisions, right? You want to protect your kids from thing X, whatever it is. Well, here's what the topography looks like. Here's that you can help make the decisions, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to take the books out, but we're also not going to just put them out there with no context or additional information to help you make a decision. It is interesting. Here's the thing. Screening everything your kids consume is work, and it's a lot of work. And that means you basically have to pre-screen or read or whatever a bunch of stuff your kids are going to or potentially could consume. I know this because I watch almost every movie my kids see before they watch it, except Pixar and some other things like that. And you know what? It's work. I choose to do that because I care about it. I have different sets of cares, I think, than some of these people that are trying to protect. There's not enough air quotes in the world, their kids from LGBTQ themes or whatever else they think that's going to mean. It's hard to know because, like, what is the library's role here? It's like, are they the curators? Are they just shelves where stuff sits on? Are they the deciders of what kids can and can't do? The answer, unfortunately, is kind of all of them, right? I mean, depending on where you are in the kid and the subject, it's very difficult. And I think there's some justice in having parents feel some of that difficulty, frankly. But that's my opinion of it.
Yeah, I agree.
We're going to take one last break. We're going to do a non-book thing after the break, but stick around for that. We're kind of tipping our hand by using Good Place replacement value expletives in the show. Both you and I really loved The Good Place that just recently ended. It had a Da Vinci Code reference in the finale. I should say we are going to spoil the shirt out of the show. So if you haven't seen it, you haven't seen the finale, you haven't seen one single frame, you know, go with demons through the rest of this segment. We don't have an outline. We didn't prepare. Mm-mm. We talked about we might talk about it. So what do we want to say about The Good Place, Rebecca? Like, I'm not even sure where to begin. I mean, maybe let me ask you this. Where on your network half-hour TV shows does this rank?
Ooh.
Why don't you think about that for a minute? I hit you with that.
And
the reason I frame it that way is because I have Jeff's heuristics for ranking TV shows. There's a huge tome right here. I don't need to show it all
to you.
I was
going to say, like, shocking, you already have a whole set of criteria.
We talked about this when we talked about Mad Men a million years ago, that I think for me it's the best TV show I've ever seen because I grade on curves that if you don't use guns, it's a different show. Right? For, you know, the Breaking Bads and the Sopranos of the worlds. Like, they have Chekhov's gun, you know it's going to be used. Like, violence and death and that kind of thing has its own kind of stakes. I think where the stakes are more character, it's much more difficult to do, and I find much more satisfying. And though network half-hour comedies are its own, I can't compare that to The Wire. I'm just not going to. It's a different thing. So I put it in its own category, which is network half-hour comedies. But even as I say that, I'm like, comparing this to Friends seems absurd in the highest degree, and maybe that's where we should start. Its singularity is what made it so special, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Like, the pitch for it is functionally, this is a half-hour comedy about morality, ethics, and how to be a good person. And you're going to, like, learn a lot about philosophy and face, like, discussions about difficult, like, eternal ethical dilemmas And it will be fun and funny and charming and warm and sweet and surprising and creative. And like, I just, that's a tough pitch. Like, somebody walks into the boardroom at NBC and is like, so here's the deal. We're going to make a show about what does it mean to be a good person? How do you become a good person? And it's not going to be preachy, but it should be inspiring. That's so hard to do that I was in on the idea of it, but like the execution of it all the way through is, I think singular is the right word there, and is such a level up. Like, Mike Schur's other work is incredible. And, you know, we both deeply love Parks and Recreation. I know Brooklyn Nine-Nine is one of yours too, but this is like a whole other beast.
It really is. And it's, they somewhat Trojan horsed people's affection for the Schurverse of those other, because it tonally on a beat to beat moment, it can feel a lot like those other shows, but the superstructure is so completely different. And I think the first season of The Good Place is, you know, it's in the pantheon for me of TV seasons of all time. Push comes to shove, especially I think the subsequent seasons, I really love them and I'm glad they exist. But at the end of this season finale, the first episode, I'm not sure I ever felt like that about a TV show before, that anything could happen. Yep. I had no idea what to expect. And also, I wanted another one, but I also might be okay if there was never a single episode after that. My friend Jeremy and I talked about that, of like, it's like a magic trick of the soul, what they've pulled off of The Good Place. And you think about people, like, Schur is a little unusual among all TV creators, but even amongst the TV creators that have gotten multiple swings at the plate and sort of built on their success, you think of like, you know, the classic ones like the Dick Wolfs of the world and like Law and Order, Poughkeepsie and all this stuff. Like, interesting, like some people do more of the thing in the NCIS and whatever. And even like Shonda Rhimes kind of does similar kinds of things, whether it's Scandal or Grey's Anatomy or whatever. Schur took his kind of bonus project and made this. And it feels like kind of the show, only he could make, but also kind of felt like everything else was sort of leading to this chance to do this kind of thing. Because I don't know, no one's going to do this with a new person, right? He needed like three giant hits in order to get a yes for this.
Yeah, and I think there's, I have not watched much Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but there are seeds of this that you can see running through, or threads of it running through Parks and Recreation.
You know, like
Leslie Knope is kind of a proto Eleanor, but who starts as a good person instead. Like, she's so concerned with what does it mean to be good and dedicated, and she kind of ties herself up in knots, and sometimes she missteps because she wants so hard to be good. And I think you can kind of see Schur like working out some of this on her. Like, she's not quoting Kierkegaard. You're not talking about the trolley problem with like Ben and Leslie aren't sitting around talking about philosophy, but those characters' lives are still guided by these kinds of questions, that like existentialness. And I loved that. Like, I loved that about Parks and Rec, but I really loved seeing it be made the central focus of a television show, but especially of a half hour comedy. Like, what is it to be a person? What are the things that like almost everybody is really consumed by in the big picture of their lives? Like, am I good? And how will I know?
Right.
And am I doing this right? Like, am I living my life the right way? Am I going to feel good about it in the end? How would I even know? And getting to experience that and have reflective moments about it through the lens of these characters who are dead and have to look back at their lives was just really amazing.
I'm not sure what else we even want to say if without making it into its own like adaptation, even like we did with Watchmen, which it could probably bear, but it's four seasons versus one, which is part of the charm of doing the Watchmen one. I mean, probably if you were to do it for The Good Place, maybe you could probably reasonably watch the first season and the last season. Because the middle seasons are interesting and a lot goes on, but you could kind of draw a through line and maybe, you know, with one additional episode or two, you could put it. I think where they start and where they end is so important. And what really struck me as being moving and interesting and radical about the end, and I'm really going to spoil it now, is the idea of being good is one thing, but ultimately the question the show was asking was about happiness. And that's what really struck me as being the bait and switch, because frankly, being a good person is not complicated. It's not easy. I don't think, but it's not ultimately complicated. And that's one thing I think Chidi was trying to teach Eleanor. Mm-hmm. Like he thought it was more, he felt it was more complicated than it actually was. Like he was, you can get things wrong and still be good, where Chidi was trying to be right all the time. And that got him into trouble. But the more radical question to me is ultimately that happiness is fleeting. It is impermanent, and permanent happiness is a contradiction in terms. Like Aristotle's famous definition, which I don't think made it into the show, though it could have easily, is the desire to have the things you want and keep them forever, right? And like the keeping them forever, but then the having them and knowing you're going to have them forever actually isn't happiness, weirdly, is what the show postulates, and it's a situation we never get into. But ultimately, the end goal, the winning, how to win the TV show Good Place was to get to the place in the afterlife where you're ready to no longer exist, which is a crazy thing for a TV show to say in a half-hour Commodore Network TV.
It is. And I keep going back to this idea of Mike Shore going in to pitch this show and being like, so it's not about being happy. It's about, like, I ultimately think really the show was concerned with meaning more than happiness. And
yeah, and they get all rolled into one. You're totally right about that.
Yeah, and they do get all rolled into one. And certainly self-help gets rolled in that direction of, like, how to be happier. But there's been a lot of really interesting research, and I read a great book a couple of years ago that I'll have to remember the title to, but there's something about meaning in it that sort of gathers all of this contemporary, like, social psych research that really says, like, at the end of life, the way to be satisfied with the life that you've lived is to feel that your life was one of meaning, not that it was one that was happy. And that we see the characters really get to that in the last couple of episodes about, like, okay, you're ready to leave when you feel like you've given all the things that you have to give, not when you feel that you've gotten all the things you wanted to get.
Right.
I loved seeing that, and I loved imagining the conversations that I hoped viewers were having in their own hearts and with each other about it afterwards, about, like, what does that mean, and what would it, like, really the question that Shore has left us with is, what will you need to feel like you can go?
Yeah. It's fascinating, and I mean, there's an element to the show that is high-level college dorm bull session, which is great. There's a part of it, too. And its treatment of philosophy as a insufferable former philosophy major is, you know, look, it's surface because it's what it is, but it's there. I mean, you get really abstruse references to text. Plus, for my money, for me, has the single greatest joke of any TV show I've ever seen. And it was, who died and left Aristotle in charge of philosophy? And Chidi's like, Plato! I mean, it's just... I can go. I can walk through the green door after that, like, for TV jokes.
I think that this show is, like, the center of our mutual wheelhouse for a lot of reasons, but the marriage of highbrow and lowbrow and, like, intellectual and just straight up funny was really beautifully done for those same reasons. Like, you got those jokes, but then they also had, like, I think mostly it was Megan Amram who did the work of the punny names for places.
Yeah, right. And it was bawdy in a way that, the limits of the network TV. And all sorts of stuff there. I guess, we kind of said the nut of our affection for it. Any particular shout outs to characters? Like, a beautiful, wonderful cast in a lot of ways. Anyone stand out for you as being a revelation or having the hardest job or executed the best? Just who do you give special props to for the performance?
I think special props to Ted Danson, because he was just, it was just delightful and fun watching him all the way through this, and such a sort of evolution of him as an actor. But also, like, I just want to see Ted Danson saying "take it sleazy" for the rest of my life. Like, if every morning I got woken up with a gif of Ted Danson saying "take it sleazy" or like that, like, would be great. And Manny Jacinto, who played Jason, I think he had the hardest job.
That was my pick. Tell me about why I was gonna
because
pick him.
The character is supposed to be so dumb. Mm-hmm. And it, like, I think it would be both fun and really difficult to play that kind of character, because he also has depth and he's coming to realize some things. And the interviews that I've read and the stuff that I've watched where the whole cast gets interviewed, like, I think that that character is the furthest off of the actors.
Oh, I haven't seen I've intentionally avoided any interviews. I don't want to hear short. I will probably go back and read like the stuff now, like how the thing was. But I didn't want to know anything week to week, episode to episode. Yeah, I think like
in 5 years, I want a really good, long oral history of this that interviews all of them and talks about it. I haven't watched too much, but like I follow a bunch of them on Instagram and occasionally I click through to stuff. I think he had the hardest job because that character represented a really big arc. Like they all had arcs, but he had a really big arc and a lot of work to do in having to, the character had to go the most way, the farthest way to understand this stuff. And he just played it so well. It was fun to watch you without being mean to Jason's character. And we got to laugh at him, but also really care for him in a way that I think that's just a tough line to walk. And he did it, I thought, really, really well.
I think... Again, I don't know anything about acting other than having watched a million things. But what he was doing was different than what the other character, what the other actors had to do. It was just a different, the mannerisms, the speech patterns, the facial expressions, like his whole being was just operating on a different sort of satirical meta level.
Yeah, like he
that only Jamila Jamil kind of had to deal. But even then, it wasn't quite so fully embodied as a, I don't even know, like a whole like identity manneristic package rolled into one.
Like
if it was remarkable shit.
I think so. Like he could have, it could have so easily come off as like a caricature of itself, but it was so.
And sometimes it was, and sometimes it kind of was, but then it would come back in ways I don't understand.
I think the first time I really realized it was the first time I saw Manny Jacinto get interviewed on something. And I was like, oh, he's a completely different person. Like it was shocking to me that the voice coming out of him and the speech patterns were not Jason Mendoza's voice and speech patterns and, you know, like talking about Blake Bortles.
Like
that just so much incredible work there. And I loved the relationship between Eleanor and Chidi and the evolution there of like, you know, and I think we saw this with Leslie and Ben on Parks and Rec, like two people really just trying to like figure it out feels just so true to life. Like this is just so honest about what any kind of relationship is, but some like a long-term romantic partnership that goes the arc from like hot diggity dog we kissed for the first time and it was amazing to like what are like we got to be with each other through like 400 versions of eternity now and what does that mean and how do we make this work. I loved watching that.
And it's one of those shows too where you could I think get hung up on the show's internal logic and the rules, and are they obeying the rules? I mean, there is a world in which you could really nitpick it to death about, especially in the middle two seasons. But I think if you can let some of that go and follow the emotional and intellectual beats at the same time, I think they go hand in hand. And that's one of the things I think the show is trying to pull off is like how you think about things and how you feel about things. Neither of them has to win. They can work hand in hand, which I really appreciated too. It is satisfying in the end in a way that it's not, I mean, like both of us like interesting messes. And I think in a lot of ways, the finale is an interesting mess in the best possible way. There's enough ellipses and ambiguity and question marks, but also you don't want the next episode. You don't want one more episode to wrap it up. So I'm not sure how you do it. I think for me, it's probably one of the best season or series finales I've ever seen, if only degree of difficulty. Degree of difficulty alone puts it up there. But for a combination of paying off the intellectual, emotional, philosophical, existential, ontological questions that it was asking without being descriptive and overdetermined. I just don't know how you do this. It's a wonder to me and a miracle of a show for something that's on network television.
Yeah, the fact that it was out on NBC and that enough people watched it to run it for four seasons.
Yeah.
Like a half-hour comedy about philosophy and what it means to be good.
Yeah.
Like, this encourages my soul that people are interested in this and wanted to watch it.
It's so funny, too, because I think you, like I, grew up on the generation of network comedies like the Seinfelds, the Friends, the Everybody Loves Raymonds, which I liked all of those shows. I will watch an episode of any of them if they come on. But if not outright misanthropic, they certainly weren't. Their anthropology wasn't super high. Their opinion of humans writ large wasn't super high. The Shureverse, say what you will about the Ticks, and it has mannerisms and ticks and flaws and foibles like any universe, and any universe does, any artistic vision does. But what's inescapable is kind of a a hearthstone of goodness that it's trying to articulate that you just don't, I can't think of an analog, like seriously, outside of children's TV programming, I can't think of anything that's so like open-hearted. Yeah, I can't think of anything.
It is so open-hearted. And so you do have to buy in from the get-go on this show to the notion that people are fundamentally good and want to be good and want to help and support each other. And that kind of optimism doesn't usually sell. It's hard to sell it. It's hard to package it. It's like the antithesis of Mad Men.
Right.
You know, and Breaking Bad, like most great TV is made about people who aren't very good because that's complex and interesting. It's really hard.
It's the gun problem writ large, right?
It is.
It's
really hard to make people who are just trying to live a good life interesting on TV or in a book or anything, like just a nice person or a fundamentally good person who's muddling through. That's a next level of difficulty. It's just really hard. And I feel like Mike Schur cleared that bar and then some. I totally agree about the finale. It was very satisfying. It left enough questions unanswered. And really every season set up a different challenge for the writers of the show. And they met each one. Like I started the second, third and final season being like, how are they going to do this? Mm-hmm. And you're right. There's some messes in the middle seasons, but by the end of the season, it was like, oh, okay, they did it. Like they have done the thing that they set out to do in each season. I loved it. I've been thinking like, do I want to rewatch the whole thing? Or do I just want to let it like live in my heart the way that it felt to have watched it and experienced it with the wonder and the surprise was such a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea, I mean, much like the setup of the show where basically in the afterlife, the supernatural beings that live there have carte blanche to create whatever they want. Mm-hmm. The show kind of also had the same power from episode to episode. They could do kind of whatever they wanted. They had the same blank slate that the architects had. And to watch them manifest different versions and put the characters in different situations and then have the creators and the characters get, quote unquote, out of them episode by episode and season by season. There's a structuralist, like there's like a post-structuralist reading of this that I would have really been into reading when I was 27. I'm too old for this now. but I'm sure there's some fascinating academic criticism show out there as well. All right. Anything else, Rebecca, before we said maybe as much as that was a pretty good unplanned, I guess, tribute to The Good Place.
Yeah. I feel satisfied.
If you're sure, what do you do next? After that, I mean, good Lord, what?
I don't know. I think that, well, he continues to be able to do something new and different and more challenging each time. So I am sure there will be another thing from him.
Yeah.
But I'm also fine if there's not. Like,
I'm not as a consumer. I just mean, if I'm Michael Schur, does he walk through the green door? Like, is this your green door as a TV artist? Maybe.
Man, I think it would certainly be justified for this to be his green door. Like, this is an accomplishment. And I think it would be great, like totally acceptable and understandable for him to be like, I've done the thing. This was my work and I have done it. And then go on and do something else or sit on the beach for a while. I don't know. But like, clearly Mike Schur has read some philosophy and is concerned with these questions.
Yeah.
And this to me sort of hints that like there might be other things for him to do that aren't around.
He's got a novel in him. Come on, Mike Schur. Yeah. You've got a novel in you. I know you do. You've got a half a draft of something stashed away somewhere on some external hard drive.
Some kind of like great, very accessible, funny, fun, like podcast about philosophy. Like this is the thing that I want now. I want to listen to Mike Schur talk about philosophy for, you know, like 5 minutes twice a week.
Yeah. Super good. Yeah. Hi. So A on The Good Place. I mean, it really is. The first season is what, 6-8 episodes? I can't even
remember
now. I think
it's
8,
yeah.
And they're 22 minutes. They're on Hulu. You got yourself a Friday night and you haven't checked it out. I would be shocked, especially as someone who listens to this show, if you weren't taken in by the particular charms of The Good Place. I would be surprised. No one I've talked to that have seen it hasn't at least recognized that it is a curveball of interesting design and angle. All right, that's our show. We said next week you're going to hear us talk about Kitchen Confidential, which we're going to record in 5 minutes. So who knows what untold horrors we will commit against that book and Tony Bourdain's work and legacy. We will try to do it justice. Thank you, guys. Podcast@bookriot.com. If you want to send us an email, you can get show notes to this and all episodes of the Book Riot Podcast at bookriot.com/listen. Rebecca, I'll talk to you very, very soon.
Thanks.